Thank you to those of you here in the room, to those of you on the phone, and those watching via webcast. CDC works around the clock and around the globe to save lives and protect people from health threats. Today, we'll hear from CDC Director Tom Frieden, who has just returned from West Africa. Following his remarks, we'll take questions from media in the room and on the phone. Thank you. Dr. Frieden.
Thanks very much for joining us today. I've just returned from West Africa yesterday. I visited all three countries where Ebola is spreading. The men, women, and children I met and spoke with, the healthcare workers who are responding, the people from within countries, the patients, the survivors, and relatives of those who've died will always be with me. The bottom line is that despite tremendous efforts from the U.S. government, from CDC, from within countries, the number of cases continues to increase and is now increasing rapidly. And I'm afraid that over the next few weeks, those numbers are likely to increase further and significantly. There is a window of opportunity to tamp this down, but that window is closing. We need action now to scale up the response. We know how to stop Ebola. The challenge is to scale it up to the massive levels needed to stop this outbreak. This is really the first epidemic of Ebola the world has ever known. By epidemic, what we mean in public health is that it's spreading widely through society, but it's not spreading in new ways according to everything that we know. It's spreading from just two roots: people caring for other people in hospitals or homes, and unsafe burial practices where people may come in contact with body fluids of someone who's died from Ebola. That is really the Achilles heel of this virus. We know how it spreads. We know how to stop it from spreading. The challenge is to do that everywhere that's needed. In order to do that effectively, speed is key. The number of cases is increasing so quickly that for every day's delay, it becomes that much harder to stop it. There are three key things that we need. The first are more resources. This is going to take a lot to confront. The second are technical experts in healthcare and management to help in country. And the third is a global, coordinated, unified approach. Because this is not just a program for this is not just a problem for West Africa, it's not just a problem for Africa, it's a problem for the world, and the world needs to respond. I'll start with what's happening now and some of the things I saw. I met a young woman, I'll call her Fatima. She's 22, she's in the fourth year of a four-year program at university, and her sister-in-law came to visit from Sierra Leone. She's Ghanaian. Her sister-in-law's young child, daughter, 10 years old, was ill. She held the child in her arms and comforted her. That's how she became infected with the Ebola virus. Because other people in her family had also become ill and been diagnosed, she learned early that she had Ebola, and she was able to go to the treatment unit, and she was able to be saved. Earlier treatment with the tools that we have at hand saves lives and reduces spread in the community. While she was in the treatment center, I asked her what was the hardest thing about it, and she broke into tears. She said that she was next to her big brother when he died horribly from Ebola. She was horrified by the symptoms he was having. She was horrified that she couldn't help him. She was terrified that she was next. That's the kind of reality that people in this region are dealing with every single day. I went into the Ebola treatment unit that Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, has set up. And there I saw patients surviving, patients recovering, but also tremendous needs. MSF is working under incredibly difficult circumstances. So difficult that it's even hard for them to keep up with providing basic care for the people there. But by helping get those people care, they're saving lives and they're preventing spread in the community. In some ways, what I saw, in some ways, the most upsetting thing I saw was what I didn't see. I didn't see enough beds for treatment. So in one facility which had just opened with 35 beds, there were 63 patients, many of them lying on the ground. I didn't see data coming in from large parts of the country where Ebola might be spreading. I didn't see the kind of rapid response team that's needed to stop a single cluster from becoming a large outbreak. I didn't see the kind of efficient management systems and support and transport and jeeps that are essential for a rapid and effective response. Bad as the situation is now, everything I've seen suggests that over the next few weeks, it's likely to get worse. We're likely to see significant increases in cases. Already, we have widespread transmission in Liberia. In Sierra Leone, we're seeing strong signs that that will happen in the near future. That's why I spoke to people at every level of each society, from patients, survivors, families, healthcare workers, people who run healthcare care facilities, ministers of health, and each of the presidents, to think about what we can do together to get this under control. Because it's not just in the interest of these countries to get it under control. For every day that this continues to spread in West Africa, the likelihood of someone getting infected and becoming sick elsewhere increases. And we expect that there will be more people in countries like Senegal and Nigeria who come in and have the illness. That means that as long as Ebola is spreading anywhere, all of us need to be concerned and make sure that we're identifying people who could have it and taking prompt action so it doesn't spread. There's also a real risk to the stability and security of societies, as governments are increasingly challenged to not only control Ebola, but provide basic health services, security services, and keep the government running. The stability of these countries, of their economies, of their neighbors, and of others is increasingly at risk. And there is a theoretical risk. It may be very low. We simply don't know that Ebola could become easier to spread through genetic mutation. That risk may be very low, but it's probably not zero. And the longer it spreads, the higher the risk. Now, faced with all of those challenges, it's certainly possible to feel hopeless. And there are times in my career where challenges have seemed to be overwhelming. But it's not hopeless. We do know how to stop Ebola. The window of opportunity is not yet closed. We can turn this around. Sometimes the problem can seem so large, it's hard to get started. But we can chip away at the challenges one by one and begin getting the situation under control. We can work with communities that don't yet have Ebola in these countries to have them well prepared so that if a single case occurs, it stops there. We can work in the communities where Ebola is spreading widely to make sure that we tamp it down as much as possible and we give care and treatment to those who need it. The countries are willing. In an Ebola treatment unit run by Doctors Without Borders, MSF, more than 90% of the staff are local. I saw a unit in Conakry, the capital of Guinea, where there was only one international staff, or two international staff working last week. The Ghanaians, the Liberians, the Sierra Leoneans are learning how to handle this. Each of the presidents said virtually the same thing to me. Tell us what to do and we will do it. If we can't do it, help us to do it. Teach us to care for Ebola patients, to set up an Ebola treatment unit, to manage the system more effectively. And if we can't do it ourselves, help us with those things, whether it's trucks or personal protective equipment or more medical experts or more management experts. The countries are engaged. They're willing to stop it. They need the world to work with them. This isn't just these countries' problem. It's a global problem. In the Ebola Treatment Center, I got a sense of what it's like to work in personal protective equipment. It's roasting hot. It's very difficult to move. It's a very distressing environment to work in because you see the enormous needs and you realize that there may be some risk. Sweat pours down into your goggles and into your eyes. The ability to start an intravenous line or draw blood is hard working with two sets of gloves. That's the kind of difficult environment people are working in, but MSF has never had the slightest problem getting people to work there from within the countries. They train them, they support them, and the people in the countries themselves are willing to do their part. I talked to the director of one group that does very important work. It's a little gruesome. It's the burial team. And the number of dead bodies is increasing. And it's hard for the burial team to keep up. The burial team needs to work in that same full personal protective equipment. You need multiple members there to make sure that they're removing the bodies safely. One of the teams was working till 10 o'clock at night. And when they got home after making sure that they safely removed their personal protective equipment, their family and their community was not letting them sleep in the house because of ostracism and stigma. They had to sleep on the ground. And they got up first thing the next morning to begin the same work because they're committed to stopping the outbreak. And all of us have to have that same level of commitment. All of us have to ask what we can do to stop it. I went to a call center where 100 volunteers are working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, without pay, to answer thousands of calls a day and route them to where people can address people's needs. Every community has strengths, and one of the challenges is to identify how to enlist those strengths in fighting Ebola. For example, there are large businesses in these communities that have taken a role in supporting the efforts. I went, for example, in Liberia to the Firestone Company, which is, as I understand, the largest rubber plantation in the world. They had Ebola cases. They realized they were going to have to manage them themselves. They created an Ebola treatment unit. They got the floor plan. They did it themselves. They trained their staff, and they admitted everyone who had Ebola. They got the tests done by the CDC lab there, and they identified 73 contacts. They placed all of those contacts into rooms and monitored them for 21 days. 11 of those contacts became ill with Ebola. They immediately put them into the isolation facility, and they did not have a single additional case. Their Ebola outbreak stopped. The same thing was done by the military in Sierra Leone. So those same tools that are working to stop Ebola in individual communities need to be scaled up widely throughout Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea, which is in considerably better shape as of today, needs to take this as a warning because they also have seen a big increase in the last couple of weeks. The approach has to be specific to each community. In theory, it's not hard to stop Ebola. We know what to do. Find patients quickly. Isolate them effectively and promptly. Treat them. Make sure their contacts are traced and tracked for 21 days, and if they develop fever, do the same thing and make sure they're tested and treated. Make sure that healthcare is safe and that burial practices are safe. The challenge is not those efforts. It's doing them consistently at the scale that we need. One of the most experienced Ebola experts in the world was there on one of my site visits, and his comment to me, I think, really sums up what's needed. He said, "What has worked to stop every Ebola outbreak until now will work here if we can get it to scale." And that's the number one challenge. And that's why I do have hope. That's why the window isn't yet closed, because we can make progress community by community, little by little, to begin to turn it around. We know how it spreads. We know how to stop it. There's a lot that everyone can do. If you want to help, there are great groups that are helping out there, whether it's MSF, Doctors Without Borders, UNICEF, the CDC Foundation, or any other group that's helping on the ground. If you have specialized skills and are willing to work and have worked in this kind of environment before, it's not something for someone who hasn't been there before in this kind of environment, not only doctors and nurses, but people who know how to run a healthcare facility in a low-income country and work in austere environments, contact a group like MSF or the World Health Organization or Save the Children or others that are involved and see if you can be of assistance, if you can do that. And for everyone else, it's really important to recognize that we are all in this together. Like it or not, we're in an interconnected world. And what happens in West Africa has a direct bearing on our own ability to go about our lives. We can stop worrying about it here when it's controlled there. But the window of opportunity really is closing. I could not possibly overstate the need for an urgent response, to get more patients into care, more work getting done in the communities, safer burials. All of these things will begin to get this outbreak under control. So while I fear that we will see a worsening over the next couple of weeks, I remain confident that we can make a big difference here, that it's not too late, and that we can control it if we act now. I'll also like to say that I also saw many signs of hope. I got to hold a 2-year-old kid who's healthy and kicking, and she's a survivor. She had her Ebola. Her parents have died, but she's being raised by family. She's strong. She's learning, and she's a symbol of hope. We're seeing an increasing number of people surviving Ebola. And while some of them are experiencing significant stigma in their communities, many of them are a big part of the solution, getting the message out that we can beat Ebola, that individuals can survive Ebola. There's nothing mysterious about what we need to do. The only real question is whether we'll do it fast enough. Thank you very much. I'll now take questions, starting with the room, and we'll also go to the phone.
Hi, Alex Sands, Associated Press. Given what you saw on the ground and what we know about the spread of this since, beyond the obvious health impact to West Africa, can you talk a bit about what the impact has been with the shortage of food, other supplies, as borders close and supplies can't get in? What was your takeaway on that, and how much more serious can that make things down the road if this isn't controlled sooner than later?
Well, this is a big problem. So we have, for example, the African Union willing to send doctors, nurses, health administrators, and during the time I was there, they were stuck in another country because their flight had been canceled and couldn't get in. I was going to leave on one day. I ended up leaving a day earlier, rushing to the airport because the flight I was going to be on was canceled. When I tried to get from Sierra Leone to Guinea, my flight was canceled. I had to hop on a UN charter plane to get from one country to the next. So getting supplies in, getting people to respond in, that's a big challenge. And I, paradoxically, the more the world isolates and stops contact with these countries, the harder it will be for them to control the outbreaks, the more cases there will be, and the less safe countries elsewhere will be. Like it or not, we're connected, and it's in all of our interest to help these countries stop their outbreaks. And the U.S. government is really leaning forward to do that. The U.S. Agency for International Development has made nearly $20 million available since the start of the outbreak, or reported start of the outbreak in March. That includes everything from personal protective equipment to contracts for helping with safe health care and safe burials to stop the outbreak. At CDC, we have more than 70 people on the ground today in the four countries that are dealing with Ebola. We're also sending teams to both Senegal and the Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, to respond as well. And they're doing everything from tracking the outbreak to helping improve infection control to ensuring that people leaving the country are screened to see if they have fever. We've surged, and we have in the room with us two people who've been part of that response who I'd like to mention, Dr. Meredith Dixon, who's an Epidemic Intelligence Service officer, and who spent about 2 months in Guinea. We've sent dozens of our Epidemic Intelligence Service officers, or EIS officers, over to the region, and I've been privileged over the past week to travel with many of them and see the work they're doing to help make a difference and begin to get the outbreak under control. And Benjamin Monroe, who's helped with communication and outreach and trying to figure out how can we get the message out effectively to ensure that we can have a rapid and effective response within countries. These are critical activities. We'll continue them, and it's an example of what we're doing. I think everyone needs to say, what can we do, what can each of us do to do more to stop this outbreak before it becomes even worse? Next question.
Thank you. Jean Bonner with Georgia Public Broadcasting. You were saying the world needs to respond, and the sense I got a little bit is maybe some folks are not stepping up. Is there more that the U.S. can do? Is there more that Europe can do? You know, this is, it sounds like the world is not responding enough, so what needs to be done?
There's been a lot of global collaboration. So the European Union is sending laboratories. We met a Chinese delegation that's sending a laboratory. The South Africans have opened a laboratory. The Canadians have a laboratory up and running. The French Pasteur Institute has a lab up and running. The challenge, the group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, has been doing a phenomenal job. The challenge is that the number of cases is so large, the outbreak, the epidemic, is so overwhelming that what it requires now is an overwhelming response. Rapidly, effectively deploying resources where they're needed most to prevent further spread and to tamp it down where it's spreading widely. On the phone? Do we have a question on the phone?
Yes. Our first question on the phones comes from Miriam Falco with CNN Medical News Atlanta. Your line's open.
Hi, thank you for taking the questions. I've got two. One is a follow-up to the one you just answered. Who exactly are you addressing when you see we need more help? You listed a whole bunch of countries who already are, so who can do more? And you mentioned how this window of opportunity is quickly closing. How big is that window? That's the first question. And the second one is the number of suspected cases is much higher probably. You said that, the WHO has said that, but what specifically isn't happening to get a better count of how many people have this this virus, how big this outbreak really is? Because from what you're describing, it's very dire, but if it's actually much larger than you think, health experts think, then it's an even bigger crisis. Isn't that then shrinking the window even more?
Well, we know that there are many undiagnosed cases. We know that many patients are having disease in places where they may not see a doctor, where they may not have a specimen drawn for Ebola. And one of the things that our staff has been doing is improving the tracking and reporting of cases so we can try to get a better handle on what's happening. I can't say exactly how long the window is. I can say that for every single day we don't increase our response further, it's going to get more difficult to control. The peak will be higher. It'll last longer, and we're really addressing every government, every part of society within these three countries, individuals, religious leaders, political leaders, business leaders, throughout Africa, those who can help, and for every government and every organization to think about what you can do.
But this was the same thing that was addressed by the WHO a month or two ago. Why is this still not happening? How are you going to – it's a very important plea you're making, but why hasn't it formalized yet? Why hasn't it happened?
I think the challenge is pace. The Doctors Without Border, Doctors Without Borders director in one of the countries said to me, everything we do is too little, too late. He was referring to MSF specifically. And this is not for lack of trying. The U.S. government has been surging our response. But the virus is moving faster than anyone anticipated, and that's why we need to move fast. Other questions in the room? Who hasn't asked?
Vince Sims, CBS 46 News.
kind of two questions. If you can elaborate, you mentioned a couple of times that this is likely going to get worse over the next few weeks. Elaborate onto that is, you know, when you say worse, how bad are you talking? Are you talking spreading to other countries, to the United States? And also when you're asking for help and other people need to step up, are you talking about the private sector, the medicines we've been hearing about that have been given to some patients? Does there need to be more of that over there?
I'm not going to predict the number. I would just say that we should do everything we can to keep that number as low as possible. I do think there's a risk of people traveling to other countries, either when they're ill or becoming ill in other countries. The incubation period is about 8 to 10 days on average and can be as long as 21 days. So it's certainly possible we'll see cases elsewhere. That's why we're alerting clinicians throughout the U.S. to think of Ebola and people who've been traveling to countries that have been affected and to rapidly test for it. We have helped laboratories around the U.S. become able to test for Ebola safely and accurately. So that's in place now so the testing can be done quickly. We don't think Ebola would spread widely within the U.S. Routine healthcare infection control probably would prevent most transmission. We've had five cases of other bleeding viruses in the U.S. over the past decade, four of a virus called Lassa, one of Marburg, which is very much like Ebola. And even though they weren't identified in the hospital before they were diagnosed, even though people didn't take very special precautions, there wasn't a single secondary spread from that. Now, that doesn't mean there couldn't be a family member or healthcare worker who didn't think Ebola who got infected, but we don't think we'll see a widespread transmission in the U.S. as the disease is spreading now.
The second part of that, are you also asking, when you mentioned help from other places, the private sector, the drugs we've been hearing about, is that part of the solution?
We certainly hope to get support with in-kind contributions from companies that are making things that can be used now, if those can be brought over and they're appropriate. In terms of new medicines and new vaccines, we can certainly hope that they will be available, but we can't count on it. In terms of the medicines, the supply of the first experimental medicine, ZMapp, has been completely exhausted, and my understanding is making more of it is very difficult. So first off, we don't know whether or not it works, and second, if it does, we don't have it. So we can't rely on it. Vaccines have begun clinical trials. I think that's very exciting. We hope they'll work out to ensure that they're safe. We don't have large quantities of them, and if they are safe, we'll have to figure out if they're effective and then figure out how to use them to help address the spread of Ebola. So we're a long way from having these, but any new tool we have would be most welcome. We shouldn't forget, though, that things that we have today, standard medical care of hydration, of monitoring of patients, of helping patients remain in good fluid balance, that saves lives, and that needs to happen as quickly as possible for as many patients as possible, not just for their sake, but because the more care they can receive in centers, the quicker they'll go there, the less spread they'll be in communities, the more likely they will be to survive. Is there a question here?
And 11 to 11 Alive News. It's my understanding that some human trials for a vaccine are happening now, but you seem to be implying that we don't have time to wait around for that and that we need to be quarantining it and tracking it. Is that what you're saying?
So we can hope that a vaccine works out and that medicines are proven safe and effective and available, but we can't count on it. What we can count on is that the quicker we apply the proven means of finding patients, making sure that they stop spreading disease, providing care to them, finding their contacts, making healthcare safe and burial, if necessary, safe. The sooner we do that, the sooner cases will begin coming down. Next question.
Hi, thank you. I'm Michelle Merrill with Hospital Employee Health Newsletter. You mentioned the case of the young woman who was holding the child and then later acquired Ebola. My understanding was that it spread through blood and mucous membranes. I'm assuming she wasn't scratched, it didn't have an open wound. Why would she have gotten Ebola from that kind of contact? And is there something already about this strain that's causing it to be more transmissible since we're seeing something that's unprecedented here?
nothing that we've seen so far suggests that Ebola is spreading differently in this outbreak, but it is in a very different circumstance. In this case, the young woman was holding her niece. The niece had nausea and vomiting and diarrhea, so she had a lot of body fluids. And the sicker someone is, the more virus they have. So when someone is not sick, they can't spread it. The sicker they get, the higher their viral load and the more infectious they are. And so if you have a little bit on your hands and then you wipe your eye or touch your mouth, then you can get infected, and that's presumably what happened in this case. The health education messaging for the countries that are affected is really pretty simple. Don't touch people who are sick or their body fluids. Don't touch people who have died or their body fluids. And those two key messages need to be gotten out throughout the communities. It's not easy to do. I spoke with the Minister of Health in one of the countries who had just gone to a remote rural area. They don't have radio. They don't have telephone coverage. So there are a lot of misconceptions in the rural and remote areas that need to be addressed. On the phone?
Our next question comes from Julie of Steenhausen with Reuters. Your line is open.
Hello, Dr. Frieden. You know, you were talking about the window closing. When did it open? You know, I'm just curious if the world has sort of underestimated this outbreak, given the fact that there's never been anything like it, and if sooner action, quicker action, and, a larger response might have, stemmed this outbreak much earlier and, averted some of this crisis.
I'm focused on the future, and I think what we need is a no-regrets policy. We need to do whatever we can now so we don't look back a few months from now and say, gosh, we wish we had done more then. That's what we have to focus on.
Okay, and one quick question about, you mentioned just briefly mutations. I know there was a study that also showed that the virus is mutating some. I'm wondering if you're following up or what do we know about whether or not this virus has mutated in a way that makes it easier, more transmissible?
This is one of the things that we are looking into. In general, the Ebola virus has not changed a lot over the 40-plus years that we've known it. So that's somewhat reassuring in that it's not one of those viruses that changes frequently. But that doesn't guarantee it won't in the future. And so one of the things that our laboratory specialists will be doing with the Advanced Molecular Detection Initiative that has just been supported is to sequence viruses over time from individual patients and over time in the outbreak to see if there are changes. That will take some time to do, and we'll have to track it to see if there are changes. Right now, we don't see any evidence that there is a change that would make it more transmissible.
Thank you.
On the phone? Next question on the phone?
Our next question comes from Dan Childs with ABC News. Your line is open.
Thank you so much for taking my question. we've heard since the beginning of this that the one of the challenges that you've faced is the doctor population in these countries, which is very, very low. Do we have any clues as to what the doctor population ratio is now, considering that there are many doctors from other countries there helping out? And specifically, how many more doctors are needed in order to really kind of put the kind of lid on this that we would like to?
To turn this around is going to require lots of effort. It will require highly specialized people to work in the areas of Ebola treatment. And the need is not just for doctors, but doctors, nurses, health administrators, emergency managers, people who can stay for long periods of time, 3 months or more, and who are used to working in very difficult environments. But the bulk of the response will be from the people in these countries themselves. They're willing. They need the resources. They get the materials they need. They need the training to do what they need to do. The exact numbers are hard to pin down, but fundamentally, working with groups like Doctors Without Borders, MSF, and the World Health Organization, we can help. It makes a huge difference to have international assistance to help train people from within each of the three countries to do what they need to do to stop Ebola there.
And just one follow-up, actually. We've heard that there have been high rates of healthcare workers in terms of infections and how healthcare workers have suffered a great burden in terms of the deaths. To what extent do we know that the protocols that prevent the transmission, the acquisition, and spread of this virus are in place and being followed in the institutions that are treating, in the places that are treating these patients?
For the Ebola treatment units, scrupulous infection control makes them quite safe. And I'll say, when I was inside the Ebola treatment unit run by MSF, I felt completely safe because you're basically swaddled in protective gear. If you're not risking a needle stick, the risk is essentially nil inside. The challenge is things like removing that equipment if it's soiled, and doing that very, very carefully. And Doctors Without Borders, MSF, is extraordinarily careful in doing that. So as I came out of the treatment unit, the person who was a local person trained by MSF was basically screaming at me, you know, hold your hand this way, do this, move this way, and spraying me down with bleach at every step of the way to make sure that I was safe. The biggest risk to healthcare workers has not been in the Ebola treatment units. It's been in the general healthcare system, because Ebola in these countries doesn't look very different from a disease like malaria or typhoid or a gastroenteritis. When it starts, it has very similar symptoms. So what we've emphasized is what's called triage. Put anyone who might have Ebola in this group and people who don't in this group. Use universal precautions for both, and for those who might have Ebola, assume that they do until proven otherwise. So one of the real challenges in these countries is, particularly in Liberia and Sierra Leone, is getting the healthcare system up and running again, because Ebola isn't just harming people by Ebola virus disease itself. It's also harming people by essentially shutting much of the healthcare system, because people are afraid to go, healthcare workers are afraid to go, and that's exacerbating the situation. So one of the things that we'll be doing is helping to establish a core level of infection control at every healthcare facility throughout the countries, so that healthcare workers will be better protected.
Thank you.
I feel WSB TV here in Atlanta. What changes are you guys planning on making here in the ground in Atlanta in the coming weeks and days? What are the next steps ahead? And do you have any other waves of employees that will be headed that way?
Well, we've recognized that this is an emergency response. And when we started, we were sending folks over for short terms of a month or so. As this has gone on longer and we realize that this is going to be a long, hard fight, we're shifting the way we'll do that. We'll be looking to send people for longer tours of duty, maybe coming back for a couple of weeks of rest so people don't get burnt out. But the longer you're in place in a country, the more effective you can be. And I really want to spend a minute to give credit to the people at CDC who are working there. They're working in very difficult environments, and they're doing a remarkable job. I visited rural areas where they're doing everything from making sure that contacts are traced to ensuring that the laboratory work is done the same day so that patients can be promptly diagnosed, and if there's a problem with the laboratory, troubleshooting and fixing it and taking on the work of other laboratories. We've been helping each of the countries establish their own what's called incident management system so they can have a more organized and structured response. The CDC staff are working 7 days a week, 14, 16, 18 hours a day in very difficult environments to help get the outbreak under control. We will continue to be there. We will continue to support countries and the World Health Organization. That's what we do. That helps them and it helps us. And it's very inspiring to see the kind of work that our staff do there. On the phone.
Our next question comes from Betsy McKay with the Wall Street Journal. Your line's open.
Hi, thanks. Dr. Frieden, you mentioned the increase in Guinea, which we've heard a little bit about. Can you talk about that a little bit more? I mean, how concerned are you about what's going on there? What do you think is driving this new wave? And could there be an explosion there like Liberia has experienced?
Guinea has a very different situation from the other two countries. So far, they've had far fewer cases. But over the past 2 weeks, they have had a spike in cases, particularly in one community where there's been a lot of resistance to the prevention measures that have been encouraged. This is a community which does not have access to radio, which has been isolated, and which has a lot of misconceptions. For example, when people were going in with sprays of bleach to sterilize after people had died. The rumor went around that that was spreading Ebola with that spray. So there's a lot of misconceptions that need to be dealt with. The border of the three areas where Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia meet is a dense forested region with about 1 million people in it, roughly. That has been the epicenter, if you will, the crucible of this outbreak. And that has been where most of the cases have been and where it's continued to smolder and burn throughout all of these outbreaks and where we believe it most likely started. We're thinking about new ways to reach that population more effectively. For example, we have malaria prevention and control programs in that region. That forested area has an extraordinarily high rate of malaria. If we can get bed nets and malaria treatment out, we can reduce the number of fevers. We can make it easier to diagnose Ebola. We can increase the trust of the population. So this is going to be a long and hard effort, but there are definitely specific things we can do. In Guinea, I think they're looking carefully at what's happening in neighboring countries to do everything they can to prevent that from happening there. On the phone?
Our next question comes from Mike Stobie with the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking the question. First, Dr. Frieden, I want to make sure I understood. Did you basically put out a call for volunteers earlier? I understand it to be a call for very specialized volunteers with a certain type of experience, but is that what you did on this call? And my second question is, could you give us some specifics? You said several times a closing window, the need for resources, but absolutely no specifics. Could you say we have X number of labs and we need Y? What's the Y number? How many Ebola treatment center beds do we have and how many do we need? How many doctors do we have? How many do we need? How many dollars do we have committed? How many do we need?
In terms of people, there is a need for people to help out, not going as individuals, but going as part of organizations, not just anyone, but someone who has a specialized and technical experience. And we've been speaking daily with MSF, Doctors Without Borders, and that's one terrific group to potentially work with. The World Health Organization has put out a call for foreign medical teams. I met some of them in the region who are working there in a WHO setup to help. And there are other organizations as well that are beginning to scale up services there. So, yes, there's a need for people to go to the region and work if you've got the skills, you're willing, you're able, and you can stay for a good chunk of time. In terms of dollars, as you know, the World Health Organization put out an appeal for $490 million. I think that's certainly a good start. I'm afraid this is going to be a difficult and expensive effort, and so all support is appreciated. And the earlier their support, the better. There are many critical things that have to happen, like getting more treatment unit beds up, like ensuring that the support is there for the government to act quickly, like getting all sectors of society working together and communication messaging out. And that's what we're surging at this point. We have time for two more questions. We'll take one from the phone and then one from the room.
Our next question comes from Lena Sun with the Washington Post. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Frieden. Thanks for taking this call. And it's I'd like to follow up on what Mike asked you, which is if what is needed is a global coordinated response, is there a global list, let's say, of exactly how many treatment beds and who is providing those beds? And, you know, for example, the private sector, you mentioned Firestone and what they did to keep their situation isolated and not turn into an outbreak. What about all the global multinational companies that are working in these countries? Has anybody gone to them and asked them to share their resources in a broader way? And then my last question was, what specifically did you see on this trip that changed what you had knew or had heard about the outbreak, you know, that brought home something different to you than what you had previously thought?
That's three questions, but to take them one at a time, the needs are as per a framework document developed by the World Health Organization and the United Nations. I think that's quite appropriate. It's outlined what's needed. The details need to be country-specific, and we need to get increasingly to a country-led process of identifying and then rapidly meeting needs, whether that's for an emergency operations center, a treatment bed, or assistance with the vehicles and staff needed to bury people safely. The countries have to be the locus of making this happen fast, because the realities on the ground change remarkably fast, and we have to be ready to adapt to those changes. In terms of companies, the U.S. Embassy and others have reached out to companies in the area and will be doing that increasingly. One of the companies has provided free gasoline to outreach workers for who are working with Ebola. So we've got a good start on work with companies, but it's certainly in their interest to end this sooner rather than later, and I know that they want to do that as well. So that's an area where we hope to see more progress and more things done quickly in the coming days. In terms of what I saw, I think it's hard, as well as we understand the data at CDC, seeing it firsthand is just different. And seeing the tremendous increase in cases, you know, to give you one difficult story, I was riding down in an elevator with one of our Epidemic Intelligence Service officers one morning, and I said, "How's it going?" And she said, "Terrible." I said, "Why?" She said, "Well, yesterday in the community I'm working in, there were 19 dead bodies called in for removal that they couldn't get to, and there were 35 new cases that they couldn't get to isolate and interview." That's a level of outbreak that is just beyond anything we've seen before or even imagined before with Ebola. But the other thing I saw was a tremendous commitment on the part of people in countries to stop it. I saw hope among the survivors who are living proof that you can beat this disease. I saw places like the Firestone Company and the Armed Services Hospital in Sierra Leone, which had stopped it using the same tools we've used before. The challenge isn't knowing what to do. The challenge is doing it now. And I come back with that perspective even more forcefully in my mind than I left with it. Do I have one more question in the room? No? All right. Well, thank you very much for your interest.
Thank you. This concludes today's media briefing. I invite media with additional questions to call CDC's media hotline at 404-639-3286. And for more information on today's topic, you can visit cdc.gov/Ebola. Thank you.